class, and welcome to the very last week of our Information Systems Introduction course. I'm so glad to have spent this time with you to really go over kind of a broad overview of information systems, what it means, and hopefully kind of piqued your interest a little bit at this broad level so that you can choose what areas you really want to dive into and use to make a difference in your area of influence. So I would love to start with a prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we ask, first of all, thank you. Thank you for allowing us all to persevere through all the way to the end of this course of allowing us to really soak in the new information and be able to go forward and use it in our organizations and our family, bringing efficiency and organization to situations that might have been more chaotic, so that we can be a positive light for others and use some of these skills to make life easier for someone and to make an organization more successful, to help our families. And we're just so appreciative that you give us the opportunity from start to finish to have a goal and to see it through and persevere. So we know that we will go where you call us and that you've called us to finish this course. We're just so appreciative that you've given us that opportunity to be together and to learn. And in your heavenly name we pray. Amen. So, last module, we're going to talk about ethics and information systems and the beyond, about what's coming next. We talked about the history, for instance, of information systems in the internet. We stopped around the year 2000, and so now we're going to just talk about the beyond of now and later. Here we go. Here's some learning objectives. So upon the successful completion of this chapter this week, we're going to be able to describe what the term information systems ethics means. We're going to explain what a code of ethics is and describe the advantages and disadvantages of implementing a code. We are going to define the term intellectual property and explain the protections provided by copyright rules, patent rules, and trademark rules. So, making sure that we aren't inadvertently, you know, doing something that we shouldn't be doing. We're also going to describe the challenge that information technology brings to individual privacy. So this is a big part of the ethical conundrum, is some of these privacy concerns and how to balance progress with privacy. So, and then of course another learning objective is just to be able to speak knowledgeably about what's coming. And so none of us know for sure, of course, what the beyond looks like for information systems, but we can see some trajectories and some patterns that have emerged and talk about those. Let's get started with the ethics. Ethics, just by definition, is going to be a set of moral principles, principles of conduct that really guide an individual or guide a group. As Christians in a modern workplace, I feel like there is sometimes a calling for us to really adhere to these ethical principles, where you'll notice sometimes people in your workplace are not. And sometimes it's tricky. Even some people in leadership positions within your organization might ask you to do things that fall outside of the set of moral principles and ethical values. So just being true to yourself when it comes to your organization and your families, and just knowing what those principles are and knowing how the new technology will fit into that. So looking at the new technology, creating new uses in society creates environments and situations that people haven't seen before. And when something's new, sometimes we don't know how to navigate that. So we're going to talk about that today. All right, so technology and ethics. First, we're going to talk about Henry Ford's assembly line. And I am currently in Michigan right now, so I'm happy to talk to you about Henry Ford's assembly line. created advantage in that cars could be manufactured more quickly, but it devalued the human work and the skill in the production process. When some of these things were automated on the assembly line, it took out some of that human work and skill that used to be highly valued in the workplace. So although we do have that trade-off where they're manufactured more quickly, which then helps people in other ways, certainly we noticed that devaluing of the human work. The Volkswagen diesel deception. These are sensors in cars for testing and software programming that allowed VW to cheat on their emissions testing, which ended up being discovered in the end, but Volkswagen is still attempting to recover. But having at an organizational level the fact that this was able to take place and that it evaded so many safeguards and so many ethical checkpoints that should have been in place that weren't, to have the whole organization on this enterprise of cheating the system for emissions testing, we're going to use that as a case study on what not to do. So a code of ethics is a documented set of acceptable behaviors for professionals or for social groups, what to do, what not to do. These are typically defined by the group. So whether that is a subset of that group that come together and make this code of ethics, or whether it's by the group as a whole. I've worked in, as a classroom teacher every year, one of the activities that I would do as part of our learning community was to define our own, and we would make our own code of ethics and our rules as an entire group. Now, I've seen that translate well in certain organizations I've worked for as well, where they would establish, what do we value? Where are we? So not just the where are we going for the business, mission and vision, but more so the ethical component of what do we value and how will we conduct ourselves as professionals and as individuals. They identify specific actions that are either appropriate or inappropriate. In the supplemental reading section, you're going to see some sample codes of ethics, and you can kind of weigh in on what those are, on how they work. There are Association for Computing Machinery of Ethics. It's a mouthful, but they have established these 24 imperatives of personal responsibility. So I'm going to run through these real quick. Not through all 24 imperatives, but this contains issues that professionals will have to deal with. So the first section is the General Motors imperatives, so avoiding harm to others, which is always a good idea. The second section is the professional conduct. So this is maintaining professional competence. Are you up to speed on what you need to do your job well? Respecting others by making sure that you're ready to go and that your competence is up to par. Section three would be individuals with leadership roles, and that's going to be creating opportunities for people and taking care of the people that work for you and that work with you, but ultimately that report to you, that you're going to create opportunities for them and have their best interest in mind. So part of those 24 imperatives is this section for individuals specifically in a leadership role. And then finally, the fourth section of these 24 imperatives are compliance with the ethical code. So how are you going to promote this ethics? How are you going to ensure compliance and what that looks like? All right, so here's some examples of some specific admonitions for this. And this is, no one should enter or use another person's computer system, software, or data files without permission. And that seems pretty straightforward. And again, this is kind of the boilerplate, which can be customized for each individual workplace. But this is typically a good idea, that I know that my computer system or software or my files won't be, I should assume that those will not be, bothered or molested by anybody who's not me without my permission. designing or implementing systems that deliberately or inadvertently demean individuals or groups is ethically unacceptable. And the important key word here, that deliberately or inadvertently demean individuals. So basically, if you know better, you do better. Once that is brought to your attention, regardless of intent, if you are demeaning individuals or groups, it's not ethically acceptable. And so you need to design or implement your system in a way that no longer is going to demean those individuals or groups. And then organizational leaders are responsible for ensuring that computer systems enhance, not degrade, the quality of working life. So again, going back to that that conundrum, or the paradox, if IT really does enhance productivity, those organizational leaders are charged with finding that balance of how much will enhance and how much will degrade the quality of working life within an organization. Having an ethical code set up for your organization definitely has some advantages. It's going to add clarity to the understanding of what's acceptable behavior. It's going to help with communication. It's going to communicate common guidelines for everybody to follow, so everyone's on the same page and nobody's able to, not just able to say, but able to have the reality be, well, I didn't know any better, because everyone has the same guidelines to follow. And then what happens if you don't follow those organizational ethical codes? And for instance, if you are an attorney and you work for the State Bar Association, you could have your license revoked, which would effectively, you know, end your law degree if the State Bar Association revoked your license, as an example. So a lot of things to look at here as part of the advantage is that it might help to have it written out for those that are coming from a different culture, coming from a different country. I spent quite a bit of time working in Asia, and I would say that there were definitely some differences in what would have been very obvious code of ethics in the workplace. Without getting into too much detail, there are things that were very assumed in an American workplace that were not present in Japan, where I was working, and vice versa. Things that were, you know, totally acceptable in the one wouldn't have been acceptable in the other as well. So having some of these, the advantage of having it actually written out for everyone, so everyone is on the same page with communications very clearly, communicated to everyone that this is what we value, this is how we behave, and this is how we don't behave. Now, speaking, we're talking about information systems, so this would be specifically to those IT standards, but just having a general ethical code for any conduct in the workplace is probably a good idea. We're talking specifically for digital ethical code. All right, some disadvantages. So we talked about why we should have an ethical code in place. There are a couple disadvantages as well. It might not reflect the ethics of every single person in the group, of every member. And again, that's kind of depends on how it's created. If it's hearing every voice, or if there's a subset of your population that are creating this code, but sometimes it isn't enforceable either. It's a code of conduct. It's not a legal document. So although in some organizations like the Bar Association, when you sign, or like if you're in a university and you sign a code of conduct there, there are very spelled out, enforceable, things that will happen if you don't hold up your end of the bargain, and there's consequences that will naturally occur. Many times, though, these ethical codes are kind of ambiguous and not exactly enforceable in those gray areas that we're going to get into. So AUP, those are going to be our guidelines for behavior when using technology, this acceptable use policies. And chances are, if you have taken a job somewhere, anywhere, you will have to sign this AUP before being issued technology, a computer, or connecting to the internet. Even if you're, if you go to Starbucks and you want to join the Wi-Fi, you're going to have to agree to this acceptable use policies. And basically what it's going to say is, you know, don't behave like a jerk, that you need to be held accountable for your behavior. What you say and what you do using that technology, you know, you are held liable and accountable for that behavior. So some of it is the physical things that you may not, you know, without access, copy or add or alter or delete or destroy data that you find on that computer system that does not belong to you, unless you are very specifically authorized to do so, that you're not allowed to make changes, for instance, to the network at an organization where you are one employee of that organization. In terms of a university setting, students shall be accountable for their own behavior. And let's say that part of the course that you're taking is an online discussion board. So that is would fall under our technological acceptable use policy, AUP. And so that you are just held accountable for anything that's inappropriate that's coming out of your unit or your computer. That includes making sure that your passwords are secure, that you're up to date in your software, that you that any you know, security breach is that you are responsible for just by practicing those good technological hygiene practices that we talked about a couple modules ago. So that acceptable use policy is very standard and something that you're probably going to have to agree to before you start work. We're going to get into the IP. This is intellectual property. So property as an idea, an invention, a process that derives from the work of the mind or intellect. So if you have a really good idea and something comes to fruition from that idea, something is invented, something is created that wasn't there before, that is intellectual property. And those could be a computer program that you author, song lyrics that you write, a painting that you make, a book that you author, a new process to manufacture something that didn't exist before. This could all exist as intellectual property. So when we look at intellectual property, the problem is if it's an idea and it's not something that you physically made in your hands, it's a lot harder to protect that idea. So that's why there are laws that protect IP that results of an idea, this intellectual property. So advocates of international property, they would argue that it gives inventors a reason to innovate. We know it's not going to be totally stolen. Your idea is going to be stolen because everyone has a right to profit from their own labor and their own ideas. And without that IP, that intellectual property protection, there's less incentive to be innovative and to invent. So IP laws are different where you go in the globe. And so depending if you're working on a project with a global team, like we were talking about in the last module of that globalization, the IP laws might be different in the team that is working with you. So you might just want to make sure that if you are participating in a project that might result in some of these IP issues, that you get on the same page first, possibly part of that ethical plan that we talked about, so that the IP laws can be discussed before it would become an issue. Similar to intellectual property, we're going to talk about that copyright. So anything that has an author, any work with an author, whether that be books, computer programs, songs, that author owns the copyright, or the owner of the copyright controls who can make copies of it, who can make derivative works from the original. If somebody's going to take what you did and kind of create their own thing with using that as a baseline, you have control over that. You can control who performs it publicly, who can display it publicly, and who can distribute or profit from your work. That's all part of copyright controls. So as part of that, it lasts for the entire life of the original author plus 70 years. It's pretty random, right? So let's say you pen the next great American novel, or let's say that you write a song that is a number one song in 40 different countries. That copyright protection on your property, your IP, your copyright is going to be your entire lifetime plus 70 years. If it's not owned by an individual, if it's owned by a publisher, that copyright can last for 95 years. And so an example that's a pretty common example of this copyright principle is going to be the birthday song, the Happy Birthday to You song. It's rarely in movies, and some restaurants they sing a different tune because of the copyright that exists for the Happy Birthday song. That's actually a copyrighted song. So if you're wondering why, when there's a birthday in your favorite TV show or movie, when they're not singing the actual birthday song, because there are copyright rules that go with that, depending on, again, your geographic area where you are. This article here, the Happy Birthday song copyright is not valid, from the LA Times in 2015. I'm going to put that article for you in the recommended reading for you to kind of get both sides of that argument and to see where you come down on that, that argument of the Happy Birthday copyright. So how do we get a copyright protection? Let's say you create something. The act of creation gives you the copyright. So if you write a book, you don't have to specifically, go and apply and get a patent lawyer and have a copyright deemed for you. If you created it, it is yours, and you already have an inherent copyright on what you have created. It says here, even your doodles on your notes, those are yours, those are copyrighted. Someone can't take that from you, make 1,000 copies, and profit from your work. You don't need an official copyright. If it's going to be used commercially, then you want to go ahead and register for a copyright with the U.S. Copyright Office. Apart from the copyright, then we have fair use. And this is, sometimes you can use a small piece of copyrighted work with permission. And so the guidelines aren't super well defined for this. It kind of depends on why you're using it, what's the purpose, what's the nature of the copyrighted work, how much you're actually going to copy and use, and the effect of the use on the potential market. So this is something that would go in front of this fair use principle, would go in front of an attorney or a judge, and they would determine if the purpose and the nature and the amount of work copied fall under these fair use guidelines. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act. This is going to be in 1998, this came about, to extend copyright laws to digital technology. So it's not just, the manuscript you have in a desk drawer or the song you have on a CD somewhere or an MP3 file. This is going to be digital technologies as well. So it was deemed in 1998 that it's illegal to circumvent technologies that enforce copyright. So, for instance, games that require you to be connected to the internet. The safe harbor law limits the liability of online service providers. For instance, YouTube, if somebody posts a video on YouTube that is copyrighted material and that video gets posted onto YouTube, YouTube isn't held liable for the fact that somebody posted that content on there. That safe harbor limits them, their liability with intention. So this Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, it's not super popular with everyone. So a lot of users are unhappy with this. The Electronic Frontier Foundation and others feel like it can really limit free speech issues. These two articles here, We Can't Let John Deere Destroy the Very Idea of Ownership, and everyone hates the DMCA, not really beating around the bush there. These two articles are going to be available for you in the supplemental readings. I would suggest that you read those to kind of get more of a flavor of the other side of the DMCA argument, and kind of, you know, just to make sure that Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that you really have a comprehensive understanding on both sides of that issue. We have Creative Commons. This offers an alternative copyright licensing. It's not as restrictive as a traditional copyright, and that would be like the textbook you're using right now, this textbook. And so this means that we can share it for specific purposes. We're sharing this textbook to further the knowledge, to share the education. We're not on the sly making copies of a published textbook and emailing these. This is a legit licensed under this Creative Commons license that allow you to use this textbook free of charge as part of a licensing agreement. Next, about patents and the difference here. So a patent is a protection for somebody who creates a new product, a new process. It's not necessarily the widget itself, but it could also just be the process that went into making the new widget. So a patent holder has the right to, and here we're going to read it directly here, exclude others from making, using, or offering for sale or selling the invention. So if it's not yours, you can't profit from it. That's what a patent holder has the right to say. A U.S. patent lasts 20 years. It's not the same in every country. In some countries, there are no patents. It's a free open marketplace. So in the United States, if you apply for a patent for your product or the process that was needed to create that product, it's going to last you for 20 years. You have to apply for this. It's going to go through and a decision will be made by a judge. A patent attorney will argue your case in front of a judge, and it must be something that's original, not an obvious thing, and useful. And if it meets those three areas of criteria, original, useful, not obvious, it would be in the running to receive a patent. Similar to patents, we have trademarks. And that's going to be a word, a phrase, a logo, a shape, or a sound that identifies a source of goods or services. So this is going to be more at the organizational level. I would imagine in the graphic up on your screen, you would recognize a vast majority of those trademarked images. If we were to play some sounds for you, I bet you could have you'd probably get most of those sounds that are trademarked sounds that would identify which organization we're talking about. Continuing that trademarks, that common trademark is TM, that's a common law trademark. The registered trademark is the symbol that you see there, the R in the circle. So if we see the difference with the LinkedIn using the R in the circle with the registered trademark for LinkedIn, we see that Google has a common law trademark, and that's indicated by the TM up there. All right, for privacy, the privacy is going to be the ability to control information about yourself, how much of your personal information is out there. So information systems have eroded some of those personal privacy in the United States. A lot of these great advances in technology that we're talking about and a lot of the personal computing, the cloud computing, the mobile technologies, some of these mashups that are used with layers of technology on each other to help make life easier, to get you from one place to another easily with GPS and to layer on traffic and to layer on weather and to a map. Those kind of things, they come at a price, and a lot of times that price is the balance between your protection and the commerce. So that's not the case in the United States, but in Europe, the EU considers privacy as a fundamental right that outweighs commerce. That is not necessarily always the case if you are in the United States. It kind of just depends. It's a case-by-case basis. It's not as easy as outweighing commerce. I'm going to look at NORA, N-O-R-A, and that's the process of collecting large quantities of information and combining it to create profiles of individuals. And this is something where it's not necessarily about you personally, but it could be all of your information that you have. So even if it's not identifiable to you, it's still collecting information about you. So what I mean by that is the individual profiles that you see in the middle here are made up of all of these different types of data points. Your click stream on what you're searching for, the order of clicks that you make in your personal computing. Security cameras and facial recognition certainly is a bit more obtrusive. The social networks that you visit and what you're searching for in those networks. Commercial transactions, what are you buying? What websites are you visiting? How long are you staying on those websites? Your telephone records, your credit reports, mobile phone data, incident and arrest systems, all of these things that could be public, could be private. It's all collecting that information. And so because that's happening, there needed to be some legislation in place. So here we have privacy legislation, COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. And this means that organizations need to make an effort to find out how old you are before you are accessing a website. If there's something with a sensitive nature, if there's something that requires adult access, that there is a safeguard in place to at least attempt to detect somebody's age prior to accessing that area of the internet. There's FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. This protects records in a school setting. And then we've got the HIPAA, which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. This protects your records just like FERPA does, but in a medical, your patient records in a medical facility, so that you can rest assured that your information is kept private and the hospital or the doctor's office or your university isn't going to sell or share your information. It is protected as private according to the legislation. So we're going to shift gears just a little bit and talk about, wrap it up with what's trending now. We talked about some of those ethics issues and now we're going to talk about what's trending for the future of information systems. So what's trending right now is definitely social. When we talk about social media, personal, having things customized and branded and having an experience that is personal to you when you're online. If not having a cookie cutter experience, that's not the expectation anymore. Of having our technology be mobile, we want exactly what we want wherever we want it. So we want anything that's available on our desktop to be available also in the palm of our hand on the top of a mountain should we choose. Our technology is wearable, and that's certainly trending with all kinds of wearable technologies, and those are advancing as we go. Printable, findable, and autonomous. These are some of the things trending. And then as we go into IoT, which you may have heard of IoT, you might not be too familiar with the Internet of Things. It's going to be embedded sensors that collect data, and they send it to a cloud host, and they tell us something. What do we mean by that? It means that so something like a baby monitor that is worn around the foot, so those little owl socks that are constantly taking a baby's vital signs and reporting it back to mom and dad's phone. These things that are constant, these embedded sensors collecting data is a trend that we see in the IoT. Air quality eggs, so an army of people monitoring air quality worldwide in this interconnected way. Is definitely another trend of things that are happening in IoT. Finally, we have big data. We're coming back to big data as one of our very last. We saw that it has been a trend and will continue to be a trend moving forward as part of our analytics in big data and what we're getting. So we can collect a ton of data for not a lot of money, and we can create new and different purposes for this information and keep innovating and building. And then we're going to find out, how do we monetize this information? So these vast amounts of information and data points that are being collected, once we have that data, as we know, in context, it turns into information. That information is turned into knowledge. And of course, knowledge is then turned into wisdom. How do we monetize this wisdom or the lower levels? And is it worth it? Is it possible? Is it ethical to do so? I guess it depends on how that information was gleaned, through what measures. But regardless, how to monetize that information is a trend going into the next era of computing 3.0. So we need to talk about who needs big data to solve problems and what privacy issues arrive from that. What new careers will be created by this data revolution? So all of these trending topics will certainly be on the horizon. So we're going to end here. We're going to wrap up, I would say, our module, but we're actually going to be wrapping up our course with the summary of what does information systems ethics mean? What is a code of ethics? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of having one of those code of ethics in your organization? Are you able to define that intellectual property, what it is, what it means, and then all the different layers of that intellectual property, copyrights, patents, trademarks, all those things that can be used to protect us and our privacy? And then finally, describing the challenge that IT brings to individual privacy, like we just talked about, the vast amounts of data that are collected each and every day, how it's being used, and what is our expectation to that right of privacy. Depends on where you are geographically, sadly, on what that expectation to privacy should be, but it's definitely some food for thought. So I so appreciate you hanging with me for 12 full modules, 12 full weeks, as we went from learning the big overview on what components make up an information system, all the way through those components to some bigger ideas, and just allowed ourselves to really think bigger on what could be possible with these information systems. I hope it has piqued your interest. I hope we did talk about several career paths that would be made possible with a deeper study into some of these fields of information systems. Whether that's a systems analyst or whether it's an IT project manager, or the dozens of careers that we discussed over these last 12 weeks. And I wish we were in a classroom together and you were sitting across the table from me and we could chat about it on what your goals are and how we can help you get there. But I hope you enjoyed learning a little bit about information systems and wrapping up with, of course, the ethics and what's to come moving forward. So I'm just so grateful that you've joined me, and congratulations for completing all 12 weeks of this course. And I hope to see you again for another one. So congratulations and thanks again.